I am actually breaking my marriage vow by expecting my spouse to make me happy.
Welcome again to Christianity at Work, the radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. Marriages can, and tragically do, fall apart for many reasons. What are some of the warning signs that indicate a marriage is heading in the wrong direction? Well, in today's program, Dr. Jack Crabtree and marriage and family therapist Christine Barber highlight crucial warning signs that the marriage vows are being broken. Let's listen to Jack and Christine.
This hour, we're going to talk about ways that we break our marriage commitment. Several shows ago, we talked about divorce as being one way that we obviously break our marriage commitment. Divorce is not just one giant step that we take to break our marriage commitment or our marriage vow. But to get to a place of divorce requires that we take a lot of small steps in that direction. This morning we're going to look at the small steps that we take to get to the place where we end up divorced. Let's look at some of the warning signals that we might look at in our marriages, see ways that we are failing in our marriages now that may be in small ways or even some large ways breaking the vow that we've made or the promise that we've made to oneness. But let's drop back for a minute, Jack, and look at what a commitment to marriage is. What is oneness?
Well, I think we have to ask not only what is oneness, but just actually even what is the marriage commitment itself. My thinking, as I've said before, my thinking is based on what I think is the closest thing to a definition that you get in the Bible for marriage in Genesis 2. After the creation of the woman, the text says, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." And as I would understand that, there's sort of two things being said there that are two different aspects of the commitment that a husband and wife are making to one another. The one is the commitment to leave father and mother and cleave to wife on the part of the husband, and the other is to become one flesh. And those are kind of two aspects of what it is that we're promising each other. I think they entail four things where I think we fail. On the one hand, in cleaving to my wife, I think what the text has in mind is that the husband is making his wife, and therefore the wife is making her husband, the highest human loyalty. They're forsaking their loyalty to their parents, to their friends, to things in this life, whatever loyalties they have had before they enter into marriage. They're forsaking those in order to place their spouse in that position of the highest loyalty. And related to that, then, I'm promising in marriage to make my spouse know, I'm promising to communicate to him or her that they are a special person in my life. No one else is as interesting to me as they are. I am not interested in knowing anyone else like I am interested in knowing my spouse. I think those two are aspects of the promise that I'm making that are related to the idea that we leave father and mother and cleave to our wife.
Well, just as a small aside, what I'm thinking there is, as I've made a commitment to do that, you're saying I need to feel a more special relationship to my spouse than anyone else. I might not necessarily feel that, but I've made a commitment to do that.
Yeah, to do that, to act that way, and to communicate that in the way I behave toward my spouse.
And if I don't actually feel like they're the most special person, I need to certainly work in that direction.
Yeah. I certainly cannot command my feelings, but I can make a resolve to relate to them and behave toward them and have an attitude toward them of a certain nature, and that's what I promise to do.
Okay, now Jack, you said there were four things that go into making a marriage oneness. That's the first. What's the second?
Then the other one is just literally to become one flesh and what that means. We've talked about that in the past. Fundamentally, it means that I'm really striving to use some modern language, to be connected with the other person, to become connected with my spouse, so that I become one with them in the sense that I so intimately enter into an experience with them that I begin to experience life through their eyes, see life and understand life with their mind, because I'm coming that close to them. I'm really seeking to understand them, respect who they are, respect their values, respect their experience, and identify with it so completely that it is as if we become one.
So seeing them not just through my rose-tinted glasses of who I want them to be or who I think they are, not just seeing them through my assumptions, but seeing them as they really are and working very directly toward that.
Yeah, that I would break that into two things. We're becoming one with someone else, and it's important to recognize that. On the one hand, we need to recognize that I have an obligation, I'm making a commitment to become one with them. On the other hand, I'm making a commitment to become one with someone who's not me, who's other than me, who's different from me, and I respect their otherness, I respect their differentness. I don't simply try to make them a clone of myself or make them what I would want them to be. I come to understand, respect, and appreciate them for who God has made them to be, which is very, very different. And in fact, we'll talk about this. One of the ways in which we can violate that is by seeking oneness, by absorbing them into myself and making them like me, making them me. So those I would say are the four things: that we make them the highest human loyalty, we communicate that they're special accordingly, we strive to respect them so intimately that it's as if we become one with them, and we recognize and acknowledge that they are a different person that I'm becoming one with. And in a variety of ways, I think we fail our vows in one of those four ways.
Okay, so Jack, in just a few minutes, we're going to come back and break those four areas down and look at what that might look like specifically in our lives, how that works itself out in our marriages. So we'll take a break for a minute and be right back.
Don't go away. We'll return to Jack and Christine in just a moment. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist with 20 years of experience. For her, the good news of the gospel is not some vague idea, nor is it just a set of rules to follow for worldly success. For her, the gospel is the message of salvation. Over the years, she has worked with people as they struggle with the weight of false teaching, misunderstandings, and bad advice. But she also sees that the real problems exist because they are sinners and in desperate need of God's mercy. Her goals are to help others become grounded in the truth of the gospel, to see themselves as they truly are, and to see that real change comes through the work of God. She's also a wife and mother who sees the truth of the gospel working itself out in her day-to-day life. Dr. Jack Crabtree is a philosopher by training, but more importantly, he is a man with a deeply passionate love for God's Word and a seeker of the truth it contains. He has spent years studying and interpreting the Bible. For him, the Bible is God's direct revelation about our world, about what it means to be human, and about God's goals for His creation. He has taught the Bible in churches in California and Oregon, as well as at the McKenzie Study Center at Gutenberg College. His goal has always been to get to the heart of the biblical message, even if it means re-evaluating many of the beliefs he previously took for granted. As a husband and father, he sees the truth of the gospel and God's wonderful mercy providing the only real foundation upon which to live his life. Both Jack and Christine see a need to strip away the false beliefs that have crept up around the Bible and get back to the heart of the radical biblical message. And now, let's get back to today's discussion between Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barker.
Jack, you just outlined four different ways that we can break our marriage commitment. The last one that you mentioned is one that's really intriguing to me, actually, as are all four, but let's start there. What are some ways that we do not respect the otherness or the differentness of the other person?
Well, I think it's not uncommon for one spouse, a husband or wife, to try to control the other person. Control how they behave, control how they react, control what they desire, control what they value, and so on. In effect, you know, they really want to create their spouse either after their own image and make them like themselves, or if not, to actually make them clones of themselves, to turn them into the man or woman of their dreams, and in that way be an extension of themselves. And I think, you know, the problem with that is I'm not taking the creature that God made and becoming one with that creature, with that man or that woman. I'm I'm wanting to be their creator. I'm wanting to play God in their life and remake them into conformity with my will. That's not what I'm promising in marriage. What I'm promising in marriage is to take this other person who has dignity and is worthy of respect in their own right and learn to respect and honor and know them. And when I fail to do that, I think I'm not keeping my vow.
Okay, Jack, you said that one of the reasons that we do that is because I want to make somebody into my kind of romantic image of what would be especially wonderful for me. I'm trying to get myself, make my dream come true, in a sense. I think there are maybe other motivations also that I might do that. Something that I'm thinking of is that oftentimes I want to control or change the other person because I'm just dissatisfied with life, mm-hmm. and I need a scapegoat. I need something, some project to work on, and I'm working on my husband or my wife to make them change with the idea that maybe in doing so my life will be a little bit more satisfying or a lot more satisfying. And I focus on you as the problem in order to avoid the sense of dissatisfaction that I feel in my life.
Yeah, that comes back to some things that we were talking about in earlier shows, that our tendency to believe the mythology that marriage has all of the potential for making me happy and to bring happiness into my life. And so oftentimes, if at all we buy into that at any level, we can often think that if my husband or wife were just different, then this marriage would make me happy and life would be so much better. We want them to fix my existence, to heal my existence, because it's just not working the way that I want it to. And as Christians, of course, you know, we ought to be able to see right through that. This whole world that we live in, the Bible declares as futile. It is empty. We are not going to be satisfied in this life. And we need to just come to terms with that. If we cannot come to terms with that, then we cannot understand what the Bible is telling us is the truth.
And I think we don't come to terms with that most often in our marriages. Usually our marriages have in some way communicate, fix me.
Yeah.
A way that I might want to be fixed is I feel somewhat inadequate, and I would like you to change so that I don't have to experience my own sense of inadequacy. I might have a strong sense of failure. If you are a success in the way that I want you to be, if you are the kind of husband or wife that makes me feel good, then I'm not going to have my sense of failure. I might be really afraid of being alone, and so I control you or change my behavior so that I don't have to be alone. I don't have to experience that sense of aloneness.
So you're not really looking for a wife or husband, then you're looking for a God and a Savior, and you're expecting your spouse to be that God or Savior in your life.
Yes, but I probably won't tell myself that directly.
Right.
I'll probably tell myself something that's very, very different than what I'm actually doing. I'm thinking of another thing, and I'm sure there's many more, but lots of times I want to change or control my spouse because I'm dissatisfied with them. Bottom line, I feel like I chose the wrong person. I should have chosen Joe instead of Bill, but I have Bill. I'm stuck with him, but I'm going to try and go out and change him so that I can have someone as close to Joe as I possibly can. And that certainly happens all the time. Lots of people feel like they made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
All of these are the opposite of trusting God. All of them are trying to make life work for me in such a way that I don't have to hurt, that I don't have to suffer, that I can just change you so that I can get for myself what I think I need. Obviously, the result of that is I have a spouse that is distancing from me, that's going to not be drawing closer to me, because that never happens except in the context of someone being truly loved. And a huge part of love is accepting another person.
Rather than rejecting them by communicating that I want to change you.
Yeah. And I think that's what controlling really means. We use the word control a lot, especially in counseling. That's thrown around a lot. But I think what we're getting at here is what I'm trying to do is change you in order to get something that I want or avoid something that I'm afraid of.
And that strikes really at the heart of our problem with our misconception, our misperception of what marriage is. Marriage is not about me finding a spouse that's going to bring me life and bring me the things that you mentioned, adequacy and success and well-being of one kind or another. That's not what we're doing when we get married. What we're doing when we get married is we're taking on a responsibility, we're taking on the challenging task before God of learning to love another person. And if we don't see it that way, we're really going to fail.
Yeah, our marriages exactly. are really going to fail.
Exactly, yeah.
But the problem is, Jack, so many of us, I mean, you're saying that biblically, that's what we're making a commitment to do.
Right.
The problem is we're really not making a commitment to do that.
Yeah,
we haven't
reality.
Thought it through.
Exactly.
And the reality also is that most of us come into marriage, probably all of us, with some pretty huge unmet needs. We're pretty clueless about how to get those needs met in an appropriate way. So we go about marriage in such a way that we get real legitimate needs met for connection, for love, for acceptance, for feeling like we're special. But we're doing it in a way that takes away from what we need rather than giving us and our spouse what we truly need.
Yeah. I'm always reminded when you mention this kind of thing, the Jesus teaching that we have to die in order to live. That's really true in the context of marriage. It's when we are grasping after the fulfillment of our needs and we are just grabbing onto our partner and trying to wring out of them the resources to meet my needs that we most destroy our marriages. It's only when we sit back and say it's up to God to see ultimately whether my needs are fulfilled or not, and if he doesn't fulfill all of my needs, then so be it. I will sit in this classroom and learn from him. Only when we take that position do we actually enter into a relationship in marriage where the marriage actually begins to fulfill some of those needs that we so desperately need met. But we destroy ourselves because in the insistence that we have our needs met, we make it most impossible for them to be met.
I think trusting God means that I really love the other person and all that love means. And we talked a lot about that in our last show. But it's allowing them their freedom to be who they are, accepting them as they are, and then accepting from God whatever he gives me in return.
Exactly. Yeah.
As opposed to me taking from them and grabbing for my needs to be met. That's a really hard thing to trust God with. That's what you mean by dying, because very often, if I'm not demanding from you, my spouse, that you give me something that makes me feel adequate, then what I'm actually doing is taking the risk that I am going to feel incredibly inadequate. If I really want to be in a place where I feel special, and yet I'm not demanding that you make me special, that you put me in that place, then I have to trust God to give that to me or not give that to me. And I think we need to add here is that when I'm trusting God, it doesn't mean that I'm not trusting him to give me necessarily even what I need. At least he'll give me what I need, but maybe not necessarily how I define what I need. He may, in fact, deprive me of a lot of what I think I need. He may not give me a sense of adequacy that I really want and I'm striving for. But that's the very crux of my relationship with God, and am I going to trust him for what I really want and need?
Yeah, what you're saying runs radically against, I think, the message that so many Christians are giving us these days, and I think it's worth highlighting, and that is we have a tendency to think that all of the problems that I have with myself and my world here and now as I am living my life are going to be solved when I come to Jesus. But you just said that, you know, God may not give me that sense of adequacy that I lack. He may not give me that sense of self-confidence that I know if only I had it, my life would go so much better. And I think what you're saying is absolutely true. There are going to be utterly godly and righteous people who are going to go to their grave never having attained that sense of self-adequacy or self-confidence. Are they any less righteous for it? No. Are they not believers? No. They're very definitely believers. But for whatever reasons, the story that God is telling through their life does not include coming from a lack of self-confidence to having self-confidence. It just is not going to happen. God has never promised that. Jesus has never promised that. What he's promised us is the kingdom of heaven, not that he's going to make this life in this world completely and utterly full. And all of human experience, all of Christian experience testifies to that fact, that that's not God's purpose. All of us, if we're honest with ourselves, would have to say, I'm a broken person, and I remain broken in many ways that I can identify and many more that I cannot identify. But I'm not being fixed. I'm being made wise. And that's an entirely different kind of thing. So I really think it's important that we see that, because otherwise we're inclined to think that something like my marriage is just the problem. That's what's tripping me up. This Christianity thing is supposed to work. Jesus said he was going to heal me and make me whole. And everything is set up to do that if my wife or husband would just cooperate here and be what I need. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's our false expectations that often trip us up.
As you're saying that, Jack, I'm realizing that we really need to talk a whole lot more about that.
You
brought up a lot of issues that will take hours and hours for us to discuss, and they're really worth discussing. You've thrown out some words like the kingdom of God, wisdom. Those are things that we could stop here and look at in more depth, but I don't think I'm going to do that right now. Suffice to say, tune in. We'll talk about it later.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, as we're talking about marriage and about the way that we try to control our marriage partner, I think I'd like to break it down a little bit and say, what exactly does that look like in my marriage? How do I actually behave in a way that's trying to change or control the other person? I think it would be helpful to do that, because as people are listening, I think they might be looking at their own lives and thinking, well, am I doing this or not? I think I'm doing it right, or maybe my husband's doing it wrong, but I'm not sure, or, you know, just kind of putting some meat on these bones.
Well, probably the most common thing is a kind of verbal coercion. We use criticism, you know, constantly carping, complaining, whining. We use sarcasm to try to shame them or mock them into changing their values or changing the way they behave or changing their attitudes. In many, many different ways, through verbal and nonverbal language, we show our disrespect for who they are. And I think it's because our motive behind that is we're thinking that maybe we can coerce a change in them. We can make them change their values and their behaviors and their attitudes and their way of being. And that can get downright cruel. I mean, just incredibly unloving, so cruel that we would never treat our neighbor that way. We would never treat another human being that way. But we're so desperate to change our spouse that we resort to out-and-out cruelty to try to get them to change.
So let me add to your list. I think you had a really good one. How do we try and coerce or intimidate, is the word I was thinking of, my spouse into changing, into being the person that I want them to be? And I think just adding to yours is correcting the other person. I was standing in line for something a few days ago, and there was a couple in front of me that I was having a kind of light discussion with, and I would ask them a question, the husband would answer, or the wife would answer. But when the husband answered, the wife every single time corrected him, told him how he was wrong, told him how it was different, gave him some different information. And as we were talking, in about the 15 minutes we were talking, I kind of felt like this man went from 6 feet to about 1 inch. I just felt horrible for him. She was undaunted in her attempts to cut him off at the knees. I was just dying for him. And so when you talk about sometimes it can be really cruel, certainly it can be. But if anybody else was looking on, say, through a video camera and didn't hear the words, they would think that we were having an okay conversation. There wasn't any yelling. There wasn't any screaming. But the reality was she was ripping the heart out of this man.
Yeah.
And it was just a very, very sad situation. We can also intimidate a person through all different kinds of threats. I think about a threat that I have heard a lot in my counseling is a threat of suicide. I remember one time a man coming to me and bringing a whole lot of notes, and he laid them on my desk and he says, "Here, look at these." And I started opening them up, and this is a man who had been threatened by his wife over many, many years, many, many occasions with suicide notes. When his wife didn't like what he was doing, when he was going in a direction that she was displeased with, then she would write one of these suicide notes, and he would then feel intimidated to go along with her and what she wanted. And he finally left her in desperation, but it was a very scary thing for him, because for him, he thought if he left her, then his wife would kill herself. So that's a pretty radical threat. We can make all sorts of threats, though. Financial withdrawal. We can threaten to humiliate somebody, tell a secret about them, say something about them that certainly they wouldn't want anyone else to know. We can do it through anger. Just being really big, really ferocious, really mean, really loud. Or we can do it through very quiet anger, through passive-aggressive anger. We can take away something that we know that they want, like we can decide not to be sexual. We can withdraw all sorts of things: love, affection, money, our time, our interest,
our happiness. We can just decide to be depressed or gloomy or basically miserable, and therefore try to make the other person miserable through my misery.
That's a good one. I mean, I remember one time that I worked with a couple who, every time she didn't like what he said, she just broke down into a myriad of tears. So she just melted into tears. And in the beginning, it looked real. After a while, it was just obviously an intimidation to try and control or change him, not to say the things that she was uncomfortable with. We can do it through physically hurting somebody, and that's something that happens, obviously, a great deal in our society. We can be verbally aggressive. You know, another thing I'm thinking is we also can do it through gossip. Just kind of saying little mean things about the other person to our friends or to the community.
It strikes fear in a partner of what other people will find out then if I don't shape up.
Right.
Yeah.
I think we could probably come up with hundreds of ways that we coerce or intimidate another person to change them so that they become the person that we want them to be. But I think that's a complete enough list. Let's come back in a few minutes and talk about other ways that we try and change or control our spouse.
Jack and Christine will be back in a moment. First, here's a question. What does it mean to take the Bible seriously? Does it mean that you carry your Bible with you everywhere you go? Well, maybe. Does it mean that you read it every day? Could be. Does it mean that you believe what it teaches is true? Certainly. But how do you know what the Bible really teaches? The staff of the McKinsey Study Center believes that discovering what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible is central to taking the Bible seriously. At the heart of McKinsey is a desire to let the text speak for itself, to understand the Bible the way its authors intended. They believe the truth contained in the Bible offers a radical message for our world. They also believe that studying the Bible is a lost art. However, at McKinsey, studying the Bible is not just an intellectual exercise. It's about learning to see this world and to see ourselves the way God does. It's about coming to terms with our sin and God's wonderful mercy. It's about truly having hope in this fallen world. If you are interested in knowing more, we would like to send you our tape catalog or our free monthly newsletter, News and Views. At the end of the program, we'll tell you how you can get in touch with us. But right now, here again are Jack and Christine.
Right before the break, we were talking about ways that we try and change or control our spouse. The one big category that you and I were talking about was intimidation or coercion. I was thinking about what is the response of our spouse when we try and intimidate or control them or coerce them. And I think often the response is that they'll become compliant.
Mm-hmm.
They'll do what we want them to do. And compliance looks like, often looks like a really good thing. I think in our Christian culture, for women, it often looks like what we call submission. I don't think it's submission at all, because I'm thinking about submission as deciding to be a servant to another person and love them. Compliance, I would define as giving up who I am, what I want, what I need, what I think, what's important to me, out of fear of what you might do to me. So in the case of the husband that I was talking about with all the suicide notes, he complied and complied and complied to go along with his wife out of fear of her killing herself if he didn't give in.
It, of course, never accomplishes what we are trying to accomplish because it's empty. And we always have a sense of that emptiness. It becomes a vicious cycle then, because I've got them to comply. I think that's supposed to make this thing work for me. It doesn't, so I put on the heat all the more to try to change them all the more. And I never get what I want. Because what's really going to be rewarding and satisfying about marriage is the genuine, deep felt respect and trust and connection with the other person. And I'm not accomplishing that by making them merely comply with my outwardly with the behaviors I want and the words I want and the attitudes that I want.
Absolutely. I'm getting exactly the opposite of what I really need.
Right.
Though I might be getting what I want, Jack. I might want a sense of superiority. And I have defined that as a greater need of mine than being respected or valued or connected to. In fact, I might indeed be very, very afraid of connection. And so I am accomplishing what I'm going after, not what God made me to need, to want, to be. But if I have made myself into a person that needs to feel superior, to feel powerful, then if I can get my husband or wife to comply, I have accomplished that goal.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. In our foolishness, we often want what is far inferior to what we should want and what we should desire. Yeah.
And it's a really sad thing, because I don't think a lot of us have this strong sense anymore of what God made us to be.
Right.
He made us to be people who are soft, vulnerable, loving people. And only in that context can we truly love and respect another person. But using those words, I think people might cringe. I used the word soft, and I thought, maybe I should take that back. And then I thought, no. I think soft, if we define that synonymously with vulnerable and open and loving.
Empathetic and compassionate and merciful.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Those are very, very good things, but they're risky. If I am a person who is able to be that way, then I'm also able to be hurt. And I don't want to put myself in that position. So I redefine what I need, and I become a person who feels like I need to be successful, superior, big, powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Another way that we might respond to someone who is trying to coerce us or intimidate us is through doing that back. You try and intimidate me, then by golly, I'm going to try and intimidate you, and I'm going to up the ante. And so the ante gets upped over and over and over again. It might be in a very loud way, where we're screaming and yelling and pushing and pulling hair, or it could be in a way that's very quiet. You're going to try and intimidate me? Well, I think I might be home late for dinner. You might try and intimidate me? Well, I might become kind of forgetful or late.
Just basically drive you crazy with little drops of inconvenience.
Or major doses of passive aggressiveness.
We've been talking about threatening. I think we can also try to manipulate through a kind of, bribery. These are two sides of the same coin, and so it's sometimes hard to distinguish between whether I'm intimidating and threatening or whether I'm just trying to seduce you into the person that I want you to be. But oftentimes, through sexual favors or that kind of thing, carefully controlling what I will be for you, what I will give to you, when I will give it to you, in order to try to get you to behave according to the way that I want you to behave. I will control you. I will
strategically manipulate you.
Yeah, yeah. So there's various kinds of manipulation that may not obviously look like threatening, or may not look like I'm intimidating you into behaving, but I am very definitely manipulating you into behaving the way I want you to.
Now, as you're talking, that kind of sends a chill up my back. What's really difficult about that is it looks like you're in giving me sexual favors, you're really being a nice guy, maybe.
Right.
And I get very confused. Why am I so angry at you? Why do I just want to beat you up? Why am I gossiping against you? Why am I hurtful towards you when you look like you're such a nice guy?
Yeah, that's very confusing to people, because deep down inside, they understand what's going on. They understand that they are being disrespected. They understand that they're being manipulated. They understand that they're being controlled. But they can't analyze it. They can't, on the surface, like you say, it looks like, look, all they're doing is giving me what I want and being for me what I want them to be. So why am I reacting the way that I'm acting? It's very confusing to people.
Yeah, but I don't know if they really understand that's what's going on. They may, but lots of people don't. In our confusion, we get really lost.
Well, I think what I mean is that they're at an intuitive level that they cannot articulate, and therefore I think that's what you mean by cannot they don't understand. At an intuitive level, though, they're reacting to what's really going on. That's where their reaction is coming from.
They're reacting to it, but they may say and think, you know, I'm just being a really bad husband or wife. I'm gossiping against him. I'm angry at him. And I can't figure out why, because he's so nice to me, and feel very, very badly about what they're doing. Now, the gossip or hurting them certainly is a bad response to that. It also is something we need to read and say, why am I doing this? What is going on in the context of my relationship that's producing this dance here? And we need to start unpacking what's going on in our relationship and not just blindly hitting back, not just blindly reacting.
And that's where the wisdom of the New Testament can be very, very helpful to us. Because one of the things the New Testament teaches is that I'm a sinner. The other thing that the New Testament teaches is that you're a sinner. And it really is to be expected. I really should understand that nice guy over there is fundamentally evil and capable of all kinds of deception and lack of love and evil things. I must not discount that. You know, out of emotional insecurity, I may want to take all the blame and all the guilt and all the fault upon myself. But the Bible tells me that it's going to be shared. I mean, that's what biblical revelation tells me, is that we are all evil people, and so I need to look carefully and become. I need to look carefully at that biblical revelation and recognize the intuition here that says something is being done to me, that I'm the victim of someone else's evil. I can't just throw that out of hand. That may very well be true, and in looking at that, I may become wiser.
Jack, I know in the past that we've talked about this some, but I want to footnote it again. You're using the word evil. Can you explain that?
Well, I just mean that as, I mean, evil ranges from very dramatic things like Hitler to not so dramatic things like the very stuff that we're talking about, a sarcastic comment that I make to my spouse, a cruel, cutting comment that I make to my wife or husband. It's evil because it is perverse. It is a perversion of what God intended for the marriage relationship, for a relationship between any human beings. There's never any reason why that should exist, that kind of attitude, that kind of response, that kind of behavior. And it's the opposite of what is right and true and appropriate and good. It's not virtuous. It is vicious.
You're not using evil for a special class of wrongdoing.
No.
You're using evil as a word for wrongdoing. And if we're wrongdoing in a way like gossiping, or we're wrongdoing like Hitler did, it's still coming from heart that is blackened by sin.
And I use the word evil deliberately, because from the biblical perspective, Jesus had to die on the cross for that little vicious comment that I made to my spouse. We want to say, well, okay, I will grant you, Jack, that, you know, maybe I will call it sinful, although I have a problem with that. I'll call it wrong. That's okay. But don't call it evil. And what we mean by that is, I will admit that it's not good and right and true, but don't take it so seriously, Jack. But it seems to me that we got to get over that. Because if we're going to come to terms with the New Testament perspective, it's criminal, is what it is. It is so criminal that Jesus' death on the cross was not an overreaction. Jesus' death on the cross is what I deserved for the criminal act that I just committed. If I don't see it as criminal, then I don't see it the way God saw it. And so by using the word evil, I'm trying to accurately portray the gravity of this wrong that I've done. It's not a trivial wrong. It's a very grave and serious wrong.
What you're saying is that all wrong is grave and serious.
Right. All moral wrong.
And I need to take that seriously. I can't say, well, all I did was humiliate my husband a little bit here. I just made a comment, but what he did was hit me. You're saying both of them come from an evil heart. Both of them are very wrong. But obviously, both of them have very different consequences and actions that we need to take toward them. It might be very dangerous to stay in a relationship where somebody is being physically aggressive.
Right, right. Physically dangerous, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. That has very different... We need to take very different actions as a result of that.
Right.
Than we might, if somebody makes a sarcastic comment every once in a while.
Yeah.
So you're not talking about what we do. You're talking about, in response to it, what you're talking about is who we are.
Yeah,
we
exactly.
are sinful people. What we do in response to different sins could be very different.
Yeah, some of us are far more civilized in our evil than other people. Uncivilized evil, as you say, is downright dangerous and antisocial and destructive of every relationship around us. Civilized evil can keep the fabric of society and relationships together, but we mustn't pat ourselves on the back for being civilized and take our civilized behavior to God and say, God, I am civilized, I am worthy of you. What we need to recognize instead is that for all of my civilization, I am totally unworthy in God's eyes because I am evil. Yeah.
I have a friend that put it this way, and I think that it was really a beautiful way to look at it. He was telling me, in essence, that he thought he was really a lot better than a man who had beaten and killed his son and was actually coming from quite a self-righteous perspective. He said, I would never do that. And this was an approach that this person has toward life. I really am different. I really am better than. After a while of thinking about this and looking at this, they just came up with this image, and it was great. They said, well, if I was undressed in front of Jesus, and Jesus was looking at me and looking at the child abuser, who would Jesus see as worse? Well, I think Jesus would see my heart the same as this other person. And so I couldn't say to Jesus, I have a better place to go. I'm a better person. I wouldn't look less, more civilized than the other person. We would look the same.
Our lives have told a different story. One of them manifests that evil in a much more dramatic form, in a much more outrageous kind of form. But the evil is evil. The evil is the same stuff in both of our hearts. I think that's the New Testament perspective.
And if we look at ourselves, apart from all our trappings, the way we can dress, the place that we live, the friends that we have, if we just take all that away and we're in our basic place, if we only see skin, then God sees skin the same.
Yeah.
Another way that we can control or manipulate our spouse to become something that we want them to do is to prey on them. We can prey on them sexually, and that is a way that we really are getting our needs met, trying to control how they behave toward us sexually, and not looking at their needs at all.
That's the fundamental problem with all of these failures, is that we are looking at our spouse as a means to the end of my fulfillment and my satisfaction and my happiness, totally disregarding who they are as a creature before God, who's made in the image of God, who's worthy of my respect and my honor and so on. Anytime I reduce them to this thing, this extension of myself, this tool for my happiness, I'm grossly violating this aspect of my marriage vow. I'm not seeing them as another person before God that I am to learn to know and understand and love and honor and respect. Maybe you could spell out what you mean by sexually preying on your spouse. You probably have more experience with that as a counselor than I do.
It can look like lots of different things. It can look like waking my spouse up in the middle of the night and demanding that I have sex right at that point. It could be that I come home in the middle of the day or at lunchtime and say, put the kids in their rooms, we're going to have sex now. It could mean touching them, patting them, fondling them all the time in times that are could be appropriate and times that are not. It is pushing them in a sexual direction to meet my needs. It is not looking at what your needs are. It is looking at what my needs are. It could be just being a voyeur. I'm looking at you dress. I'm looking at you take a shower. I'm coming in at inappropriate times. That might in many cases be appropriate, but in a marriage, but I'm undaunting. I'm going after you. I'm pursuing you. I'm lusting after you all the time. My mind is on a sexual image rather than seeing you as a person. And behind that is I'm trying to receive some kind of comfort, some kind of anesthetic, so that I don't have to face life in ways that are uncomfortable for me. And I think that sex, for many people, and I think especially men, can be an incredible drug to anesthetize me away from things that are discomforting to me, because sex is a very comforting activity. And I think often is a replacement for emotional connection.
And so what you're saying is it's not contrary to the mythology that many males may buy into. It's very dehumanizing to have my whole existence reduced to being a drug to make you feel better. It's very unfulfilling, very unsatisfying, very demeaning, really, to be simply an object for sexual gratification for a husband.
Oh, certainly. At its best, unsatisfying. I can't even imagine it just being unsatisfying, but incredibly demeaning.
Demeaning.
Incredible violation and intrusion into my very soul. It does feel like a rape to women.
I think oftentimes men, in their foolishness and their ignorance, probably don't see it. They don't see how demeaning that is. They don't see how dehumanizing that is. I don't know whether it's pride. I don't even know how to describe it. But thinking that, well, surely it ought to be gratifying somehow or flattering to you to have you be the object of my desire. But what they don't understand is that it is so reductionistic. It's turning the woman into merely an object of physical desire, and that's all. And she's so much more than that. Mm-hmm. And that may be the least of what she's interested in being. Mm-hmm. And yet, men are often oblivious to that.
I think she'll become less and less interested in that if that's
right.
What she's reduced to.
Right.
And so what he wants, which is her true sexual devotion, he will not get.
Right.
She will, not just out of meanness, perhaps out of meanness, she'll withdraw from that, but certainly out of a psychic woundedness, she'll move away from that and fold into herself sexually. Because, of course, what a woman wants and what she needs, as everybody, is to be respected and valued.
We'll return to Jack and Christine in a moment as they conclude their discussion on breaking the marriage vows. Over the years, a lot of people have come through Mackenzie Study Center. Some have come to study biblical interpretation. Some come to focus on applying the truth of the Bible to the world we live in. And others come for the great Bible teaching. And still others come because they need a place to think about their faith. What is Mackenzie? It's a group of people who take the Bible seriously, who see the goal of this life as the pursuit of righteousness and wisdom, who see the gospel as the most profound message in all of human history. The Mackenzie staff members have dedicated their lives to the pursuit of knowing the truth contained in the Bible. They see the need to get back to the Bible as more important than ever in this darkening world. Getting back to the Bible means trying to understand what the biblical authors intended to say when they wrote the Bible. And this can be hard work. The scriptures are often difficult to interpret and understand. Sometimes the Bible doesn't always say what we want it to say. But if we are to come to understand this world and our place in it from God's perspective, then the hard work of biblical interpretation is worth it. This is the passion motivating the staff and families of Mackenzie Study Center. If you are interested in knowing more about Mackenzie, we'll give you information on how to contact us at the end of the program. Then when you do, you might ask for some of our News and Views articles, such as Forgiveness, The Parable of the Unforgiving Servant by Ron Julian. In this article, Ron takes a close look at Christ's statement that if we don't forgive, we will not be forgiven. Ron's conclusion is that Christ meant exactly what he said. God's people know that they are sinners and only the mercy of God stands between them and their deserved destruction. It is this humility, without which no one can come to the cross of Christ, which results in forgiving others. Ron argues that Jesus makes this point most forcefully in the parable of the unforgiving servant. Again, at the end of the program, we'll give you information on how you can find out more about McKenzie Study Center. Now, here are Jack and Christine as they conclude today's discussion on marriage.
Today we talked about how we break our marriage commitment or our marriage vow, or ways that we do that. We really focused on a way that we do that is by not respecting the otherness of another person. Instead of respecting the otherness of the other person as a different and unique individual, we try to make them the way that we want them to be. We do that through coercion, through intimidation. And we came up with a lot of different ways that we can coerce or intimidate our spouse to change and become the person that I want them to be. We also talked about the response that we might have in trying to coerce our spouse. If we're intimidating, then we might get intimidation from our spouse in response. If we're intimidating, we might have compliance in response. Different people respond in different ways. If I try to change you by being compliant, by trying to get what I want, by doing everything you want from me, then I might get somebody who in response is intimidating to me or in response compliant. But nonetheless, in all of these responses, I'm trying to change you. I am disrespecting you as a person rather than valuing you and staying committed to my marriage vow to do that.
And I think the fundamental error that underlies all of my attempts to change the other person could be seen in a couple of ways. One way to look at it is that I'm making the person a means to my happiness rather than making them making connection with them and respect for them and love for them the end and goal of my marriage with them. And that's a fundamental confusion about what my marriage should be all about. And related to that is I'm seeing marriage as that thing in my existence that's really going to make me happy and fulfilled. And that too is a fundamental mistake, because as we've discussed in the past, there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of suffering, there's a lot of disappointment, there's a lot of emptiness and futility in this life under the sun. And nothing is going to change that. Marriage is not going to change that. My marriage partner cannot be my salvation, cannot be my fulfillment. If I come into my marriage with that expectation, I'm going to be disappointed. And one of the ways we react to that disappointment is to try to wring that happiness and that satisfaction out of my partner. And it's not going to be there. I'm not going to find it.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at 541-485-4801. Or you can write us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And if you enjoy surfing the net, look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. And I'll repeat the phone number and address in a few moments. The McKenzie staff is dedicated to pursuing wisdom, growing in love, and understanding God's Word. They invite you to join them through listening to this program, attending their classes and seminars, or by reading their articles, papers, or books. They trust their research and teaching will be used by God to minister to others. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street. That's 1883 University, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request the free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is area code 541-485-4801. 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKinsey Study Center, thank you for listening.